This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the story of a boy threatened with autism and how his family helped him to become an outgoing kid now in the first grade. Patricia Stacy is our guest this afternoon. She joins us to talk about autism, treatments for the disorder, news from the field of neuroscience, and her son, Walker. Stacy is the author of The Boy Who Loved Windows, Opening the Heart and Mind of a Child Threatened with Autism. The book is a very personal account of Walker's metamorphosis. This is from the book's description. In 1997, writer Patricia Stacy and her husband, Cliff, learned that their six-month-old son, Walker, might never walk or talk or even hear or see. Unwilling to accept this grim prognosis, they embarked on a five-year odyssey that took them into alternative medicine and the newest brain research and toward a new and innovative understanding of autism. Finally, their search brought them to pioneering developmental psychiatrist Stanley Greenspan, who helped them save their son and bring him into full contact with the world. Patricia Stacy is a former staff member of the Atlantic Monthly. She is a writer and a college teacher. She and her husband, Cliff, live in Massachusetts with their children, Elizabeth and Walker. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Patricia Stacy's book, The Boy Who Loved Windows, Opening the Heart and Mind of a Child Threatened with Autism, is published by Da Capo Press, a division of Perseus. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Patricia Stacy, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So how is Walker?
Oh, he's doing wonderfully. Actually, he's doing better than we ever imagined.
Yeah.
Sometimes I even wonder if we didn't go through all this, if he would be the perky, charming guy that he is.
Yeah, what a metamorphosis, literally, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So does he like school?
He loves school. He loves his teacher. He writes her love notes. He's a first grader, but they put him in a class with first and second graders, and he's made friends with a lot of second graders now who are eager to come to our house and play with him. And
What do you think is behind that connection with the kids that are a year older?
Well, actually, Walker's really smart, and in spite of the fact that they thought that he might be mentally retarded, he's proved to be bright, and he's also extremely verbal, which may be just a trait of his, but I really think that it may have come from the intensive therapy that we did with him, where we did a lot of one-on-one play, and it, as he became verbal, so much talking.
Yeah. The subtitle of your book, Opening the Heart and Mind of a Child Threatened with Autism. A couple of questions here. Is it possible to keep a child from becoming autistic or to cure autism? And why did you choose that word, threatened?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's sort of a controversial question right now. I think that I would certainly contend that autism is, in some cases, preventable. And I know that there are many doctors now that believe that. There are probably many doctors that don't. The idea is that autism is a developmental problem, and that what Dr. Greenspan, who is the doctor that we eventually came to work with, noticed was that certain kids with autism hadn't passed through certain phases of development because their neurological systems inhibited them from doing so. Because they were too sensitive visually or auditorily, or because maybe their coordination wasn't good, it prevented them from having, you know, really normal relationships with people. So he felt that if you could bring a child through the various phases of development, you could actually end up with a child who is creative, interactive, social, juicy in the way that we don't often associate with kids with autism.
Yeah, and what do you mean by juicy?
That's Greenspan's word. He always said, make it juicy, you know, when you're playing with Walker. You know, up the ante emotionally so that you have a lot of emotional spark in your interactions, and that kind of translates into the kid's way of dealing with the world. And I know that Walker is a really personable guy, and he goes rushing into the library and jumps up and starts asking questions and puts a lot of, I don't know, just a lot of love and energy into his relations with other people.
You suspected something was wrong when Walker was very young, an infant. What were the first signs that something was amiss?
Well, I think I sort of suspected something right off because he wouldn't look at me when we nursed. And he just seemed very distant, even as a newborn. But then as time wore on, he became sort of obsessed with looking out the windows and with light. He seemed mesmerized by light and sort of haunted in some way. I sometimes thought, is he worrying? Is he thinking too hard? He seemed so serious and grew more and more distant. Even as time went on, when we tried to get close to him, he would turn away. But we noticed sometimes it was hard to understand what was going on because if we were across the room from him, he would look at us and sometimes respond to us and maybe imitate us. But if we got close to him, we couldn't get close.
Yeah, he was overloaded.
Yeah,
and he couldn't handle it.
Exactly. Which we didn't understand at first, but
right.
Then we came to learn. Yeah, it was too much for him. In fact, one of the most fascinating things I think I learned in this whole process is that faces have an incredible amount of information in them.
Mm.
And that is why autistic people often can't make eye contact, not because they don't care about people or hate people or anything like that. It's really that it's almost they're seeing too much.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the many moving scenes in this book involves a boy named Drew, late in the story, a boy with a type of autism, highly functional type of autism. And you and Walker go to his house, and Drew isn't real interested in what's going on, but you engage him in this very intense kind of play. Can you describe that play session you had with Drew? And then to get back to where I'm coming from here, a woman that you worked with right from the beginning, Darlene Corbett, who said to you, you know, you've got to, something about drinking in the depths.
Yes. Drinking in the depths, she said that, yes.
And that goes to this business about the face and interacting with someone like Walker or someone like Drew.
Right. Well, there's a certain flatness. When kids have autism, there's a kind of flat quality that comes across, and it feels like they're only skimming over the surface of the relationship somehow, or they're just peripherally engaged. And I had, by the time that I met Drew, I had gone through lots and lots and lots of training by Dr. Greenspan in terms of how to play with Walker and get him what Greenspan calls cooking, which means get him reacting to me and me reacting to him and him reacting to me, which is what, what sort of the typical people do with each other, but it's much harder for these children. Drew's mother was brilliant at working with his body in the sense that he had had some coordination problems, which is very typical, and he was highly coordinated, and she was just wonderful at getting his body sort of in tune, which is another issue for kids in this population. However, she hadn't had a lot of training in the psychological stuff. And I said to her, why don't you let me do this? It's called floor time. Let me try the floor time with him and see if it works. And Drew was very, at the time, he was very self-absorbed in his own world. He was playing with cars and a car wash. He was obsessed with car washes. And periodically he would run out of the room and go spend time alone, maybe with a computer, and come back. And he was on the floor playing with his cars and his car wash. And I came in, and I did what Greenspan taught me to do. I revved up. I pretended I was a car. And I took a little truck, and I said, "Will you please wash me?" And Drew didn't look at me. He didn't respond. And I said it again, and I kept sort of raising the tenor of my voice, "Please, please, please, I really want you to," like almost acting, you know, sort of acting crazy, what would seem crazy. But the more energy I put into the play, the more Drew started to react to me. And he took the car, started washing it, and then I said, "Well, you know, what do you charge?" And he didn't say anything. I asked again, and he turned to me and he said, "It's free." And I said, "Oh my God, I can't believe I'm coming here every day. I love this car wash." And really, really sort of high pitched and excited, and he smiled at me, and he looked me straight in the eye, and it was like something in him came alive. And we continued to play like that, and him reacting more and more. He started charging money. I was paying him, and this is what you want to get. You want to teach these kids how to be, to do the back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and be in a what they call it, rapid back and forth play session. And that afternoon, his mother was ready to say, "Forget it. I am never going to do this with my son. It's too hard." Because she saw how much energy I put into it. And it was Valentine's Day. Just thank God it was Valentine's Day. He came home from school. He handed her a Valentine. He put his arms around her, touched her face, looked her straight in the eye, and said, "I love you." And which is something, it's a connection that she had never done this sort of thing before, never gotten that close, never made that kind of eye contact. And she broke down and she cried, and she said, "I am going to do this." Mm. And she, within two or three weeks of her doing it, he was a different child.
Mm. The floor time therapy is intense, and I think our listeners this afternoon just got an idea of that. And for some time, floor time was almost all the time. And the household so tightly focused on this. What was it like for you, for your husband and your daughter, through those months?
Well, it was, you know, it was a crisis, absolutely. I mean, sort of did the math and figured that if Walker wasn't eating or sleeping, we were having to do floor time with him. And my husband ended up spending more time with my daughter Elizabeth, who at the time was about five. So then it was even more sort of on me to do it. The state got a little bit involved and got us about 10 hours a week of someone that came in and did it, which was heaven, so that I could make dinner and whatnot. We got volunteers. I got a wonderful woman from Smith College, a student who made a project of my son and worked at teaching him some language skills when he was about one. And she made fabulous progress with him. And we all made such great progress. I have to say it was probably the most horrible and the most wonderful time of my life at the same time. I mean, there was so much, it was crushing how much responsibility was on us. And yet to see that our son was healing, that his brain was changing, was well, it sort of kept us going. In terms of my marriage, I have to say that it was on hold for a long time.
Yeah. Eventually, though, you said, time for a date, and it seems like things got back on track. But that was when maybe you were over the hump.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when we tried to go on dates in the, you know, I'd say the first two or three years were very hard. We'd try to go on dates, and I would just want to talk about Walker, and Cliff would be, I'm sure, feeling so sick of the whole thing, that he, you know, couldn't be very responsive, and we were tired. And but then we took a weekend away or a night away and just remembered who each other were, and that changed everything.
Yeah. This course of floor time therapy, how long did it take before you began to be encouraged and finally you realized, as you say, you were not in the world of disability anymore, but in the world of normal child development?
Right. When we first started doing floor time, I think we certainly saw change right away. So when Walker was a baby, for instance, when we went to see Greenspan, just that first appointment, when he was really on us for 3 hours straight to, you know, keep going, don't stop, you know, like that practically, and we saw such change. I remember we went to a restaurant and I said, you know, if you squeeze my finger, I'll give you this cup. And he squeezed. And this was like the first time I'd have that kind of reaction, where, especially just speaking it. That was an amazing impetus to keep going. I think it was about the time, really, he was about four, that I started feeling like whatever problems he had were normal developmental problems instead of, autism spectrum disorder kinds of problems.
Mm. Patricia Stacy is our guest this afternoon. She's a writer. She is the author of The Boy Who Loved Windows, Opening the Heart and Mind of a Child Threatened with Autism. This book is about her, Patricia, and about her son, Walker, and also about the other members of the Stacy household, Patricia's husband, Cliff, and their daughter, Elizabeth. Patricia Stacy tells the story in The Boy Who Loved Windows, Opening the Heart and Mind of a Child Threatened with Autism. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. The number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's backtrack here a little bit. To when you realize that there are a number of things wrong, that there are problems, and things are getting worse, and you're so worried and so right to be worried, where did you begin to search for help? Tell us about that process and how you eventually found Dr. Greenspan.
Right. Well, what we noticed was that the traditional doctors that we were seeing at our HMO really didn't think anything was wrong at the beginning. They kept telling us, we thought he slept too much. They said, let sleeping dogs lie. We were certain he had allergies. They said that wasn't likely given his how young he was. Finally, when we did talk a senior pediatrician into seeing our son, then he, after very close examination, realized he was delayed in all areas. But he didn't really have many answers. He told us to see early intervention, which we had already gotten in touch with. People in early intervention, which is an organization we hadn't even realized existed, but every state has it. It's state-funded money to help children with developmental problems between the ages of 0 and 3. And they're phenomenal people that really started leading us in the right direction. But we noticed that also that alternative medicine had a lot to offer, because people in alternative medicine have ways of addressing neurological problems that a lot of traditional medicine doesn't seem to have. We did vitamin therapy. We did something called body-mind centering, which sounds very new agey, but is really a very sophisticated form of physical therapy based on some pretty sound ideas that the body and how it moves actually affects how the brain develops in babies.
Okay, so then you're into early intervention, And you've got Darlene Corbett on your side. She's the one who says it might be sensory integration disorder that you're dealing with.
Yes.
Can you talk with us about what that is and its connection to autism?
Yes. Autism, really, there is no such thing as autism without sensory integration disorder, and it's a big piece of the puzzle. For years, it was believed that people with autism were either psychotic or just, you know, really psychologically disturbed in their emotional relationships. And then just really in recent years, it's been understood that what these people are suffering is kind of a shock of too much sensory information. They very often, there are people with sensory integration disorder with autism that who can hear the people speaking in the house next door. And I heard a story of one boy who people actually thought he was psychotic. He was repeating the voices. And the mother, years and years later, the mother realized, because she went in the backyard and started to overhear some people in the house next door, that he was hearing. He wasn't imagining. He was literally hearing. And that this kind of the shock can actually make people shut down. And if you shut down when you're a baby, it's going to have devastating effects for how you are psychologically, because, you know, we need to be relating to our mothers. We learn from our families. We learn language, all because we're listening and we're looking. And if it's too much, then it's almost like, you know, a child who's raised in a, you know, in isolation.
Mm. Let's talk with a listener who's standing by, ready to talk with us this afternoon on the toll-free line, a listener in Gibson City. Good afternoon.
Hi.
When
I was listening, I've read and know something about autism, and I understood that it was thought to be kind of an oversensitive system where the child shuts down because things are too much to process. So I was surprised that an effective therapy would be, it sounds almost like upping the ante, like you're...
Good question.
You're throwing in more stimulus
more
intensely than you would for another child, and yet... The play, the floor time sounds kind of like what a normal childhood play would be. I mean, as I played with my children, we'd go back and forth like that and make things talk. I guess I'm not sure. Is the difference that it's more intense and more prolonged? And why would that work if they're oversensitive?
Yeah, that's a really brilliant question. It is very much like normal play. I mean, Greenspan's whole point about it is that you want the child to develop the normal, normative, emotional, you know, repertoire that we all have, and that's how we all learn, is through play. In terms of these children, actually are a combination of what they call hypersensitive, oversensitive, and hyposensitive, undersensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And with Walker, it was interesting because when we first began working with him, he was so sensitive we had to turn the lights out in the room and close the blinds so that he could even begin to sort of try to look at me. And he did, when he was about 6 months old, try to turn and look at my face. And he started to even reach out and touch my face. And yet when his hand got near my eyes and maybe even when he started to make eye contact, he turned away very abruptly. It was just too much for him. It was really a sad moment. And I was very protective of him from the time he was about 6 months old to about 11 months old, very careful. But what we noticed is that over time, the more we worked with him, the more tolerant he became. By the time we saw Dr. Greenspan at 11 months old, I was being too protective. And it turns out that Walker really, in some areas, needed to be revved up. So that Greenspan noted what I was just incapable of reading, which is that Walker was undersensitive in certain ways and needed kind of that cheerleader energy to get him, you know, moving across the room and staying with me. And he turned out to have a lot more stamina than I realized and needed a lot more of that Greenspan called it helping him, because if you do up the emotional ante, what happens is, and this is what happened with Drew, is that Drew, I think, heard the emotion in my voice, maybe for the first time, heard emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And
so he may have been hyposensitive to that as well.
Yes, exactly. That, and he maybe he was hypersensitive visually,
mm-hmm.
so that it was really a lot for him to be in a room with someone, and yet maybe he was hyposensitive auditorily, so that he needed that extra help so that he could really feel, you know, the mm-hmm. the feeling from me about the meaning of our game.
And so it's kind of critical as you're working with a given child to find where they are, what's hypo and hyper for them.
Absolutely. And it's kind of like that's what's so brilliant about Dr. Greenspan's method is it's, you know, each child, you do a profile of each child, and you know, as you work, you experiment with what works and what doesn't work. I mean, if you were to try that super revved up thing, you know, with Walker when he was a baby, I know what he would have done. His head would have flown back and forth wildly. He would have kicked his legs in the air, and he would have been, you know, miles away from us.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to, you know, take someone where they're at and read them.
Okay. Boy, it's really fascinating. And the other comment I had was how you mentioned when you first started with Walker, you knew something was wrong, but the doctors didn't agree with you initially. And I'm a physician, too, and I know that one of the cardinal rules is if a parent thinks something is wrong, something's wrong. You may not know what it is, but parents are rarely mistaken about something being wrong. They might not know the name for it. And it's really great that you've just kept persisting.
Well, it's wonderful to hear a physician say that. I mean, that's it's a really humble position for a physician to take. And I wish, you know, we did eventually find some doctors with that kind of sensitivity. I think it's a wonderful philosophy.
Thanks. But I do encourage any parent listening, if they think something's wrong, keep trying until they find out what it is. Because the first 10 doctors may not know.
Right. And but it's so tempting when they told me Walker was perfect.
Right.
When, you know,
and physically he looked perfect, I'm sure.
Right, right. Although I wondered. To me it seemed very weak. But I know it was just something that they told parents, and
mm-hmm.
you know, if I'm sure if all the other things were in order.
Right. It's a hard thing to diagnose in an office visit, and that's why it's so important to listen to parents. They're with the child all the time.
Oh, absolutely. Especially, yeah, autism is, notoriously difficult because in an office visit, any kid might be overstimulated, might not be relating to the adults in the room, just because of, you know, the fluorescent lights and how quickly everything's happening, and it's a new adult and being touched. I mean, it is kind of a stressful situation.
Yeah, it is. I notice sometimes when I do have children that are overstimulated, turning off the lights in the room, and it is amazingly effective to help the child kind of settle to where you can examine them.
Wow.
Even a, quote, normal kid, especially if they won't nurse or they're having trouble, a lot of times I'll tell the parents to quiet a room down, darken it and quiet it and see, and a lot of times they'll come. They're just got too much going on. They can't attend to it.
Right.
But I'm going to listen to the rest of this, and I appreciate you writing the book and sharing what you went through.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the call this afternoon. It you know, that makes perfect sense, though. I mean, when we get overextended and we want some quiet time, you know, we put something soft on in the background and sit down and breathe and maybe try and focus on breathing to calm ourselves. So it makes sense, really, doesn't it, to maybe turn off the lights and put on some soothing music or just calm it all down.
Exactly. And I learned so much about my own neurological system from working with my son. I hadn't even realized that You know, I'm very easily overstimulated at the market, or just if too much is going on during the day, or from fluorescent lights in the classroom if I go to visit school. And I've really learned to attend to that and notice, because the nervous system, if it's overloaded, what it experiences anxiety. And just to kind of make sure I don't get overloaded, and to try to stay calmer, or just say, okay, I can't go to this party tonight or something. It's been really helpful.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line one. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I don't have a child that has autism, but I was recently reading a book called Super Learning 2000 by Ostrander, and there's a report in that, it's totally anecdotal, no study done on it, but of a young child who was diagnosed with severe autism early in life and was so bad that they were institutionalized. The mother and father had been traveling in Europe and came across a clinic in France that used sound therapy. And what I could, as I recall, what it was is they had used headphones, and they would emit different frequencies to different sides of the head at varying frequencies. And the mother became sure that this would help her daughter, so she went through the legal channels, got the child out of the institution, took her to France, and within 3 months of this treatment, she was interacting at a normal level that most children would. This daughter went on to graduate from college, and they went back to the institution where she was initially cared for, and the same people were there that were there when she left. And her response, one question, what it was like, is she said, "The sound of water running in pipes was excruciating to me. The pain was unbelievable. And if someone dropped a book or dropped a pan, I would go into fits of rage." And evidently, this sound therapy had some effect of correcting that neurological pathway in the brain. I was wondering if you had had any experience with that clinic.
Actually,
I'll hang up.
Well, I do know people that have done that therapy. It's called auditory integration therapy, I believe, maybe the last word. And it has been very effective for many children that I have met whose mothers swear by it, that it helped the kids become organized in a lot of different ways. I know, Drew's mother did AIT with him, and she said that he was able to approach children and get near them for the first time ever just after the first day of this therapy. It desensitizes or somehow reattunes the auditory system so that the kid can just be more there, not be in excruciating pain. I mean, anybody would act the way these kids act if you were that sensitive to sound. Walker has gone through periods where he was very sensitive auditorily, and we did a different therapy that was recommended by our occupational therapist and this sounds absolutely ridiculous, but we stimulated this nerve on the kind of the roof of his mouth near where his gums meet his teeth, and we just rubbed it and then pushed down on his bottom teeth. And we had to do that process about 6 times a day. And after the first day of doing that, Walker was no longer sensitive to noise, and continues to be less sensitive than I am, really, to noise often. And he just instantly, that when we were doing this therapy, which only took about a week or two, he became toilet trained, and he started dressing himself completely. I think that we did this around the time that he was about 4.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I thought, what? Wow. This is a therapy, a desensitization therapy developed by a woman by the name of Patricia Wilbarger.
Exactly.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's part of the Wilbarger protocol, they call it. There's another thing. I don't know if listeners have heard of brushing. Often it's very, what people do is brush, and it's not really brushing. It's really applying a certain kind of pressure to the skin and really the maybe the muscles of children who have sensory integration disorder. And it helps. It also does the same thing. It sort of desensitizes or gets the brain attuned to tactile stimulation.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I was stunned by this brilliant question you asked the occupational therapist then, following this remarkable progress that Walker made after doing this therapy, this desensitization technique involving the gums. You said to her, well, do you suppose this might have something to tell us about why kids suck their thumbs?
Right, exactly, because I noticed that the exact place that she was showing me where we were pushing, it's that, you know, that roof of the mouth part, was, you know, Walker's a big thumb sucker, and I was a big, and so is my daughter. She told me there's a major nerve that runs through that part of the mouth and goes to the brain. And she thought, yeah, there's a relationship, that there's something calming. She also told me that's right in the center, and things in the center of the body are sort of power spots for us. They literally center us. You know, we use that term colloquially, but that's a place of calm, and that, I don't know, somehow it helps the brain and it helps the nervous system stay more together.
Hmm. The things that you did with Walker, including what we've been talking about, and then essentially I think probably the most important piece of the puzzle was the floor time therapy, Dr. Greenspan's therapy. Is it always successful? Is this therapy always as successful as it was for Walker?
It's not always as successful as it was for Walker. I believe that Greenspan, when I first was introduced to him, I was brought a paper that he had written that was his chart review of his 200 patients. And what they found was that about 18% of their patients could only improve a little bit. All the patients made improvements, but 18%, they just couldn't, there were certain barriers they sort of couldn't get beyond. And there was another, I think, about 28% who improved moderately. They made good improvements, but not spectacular. And then 58%. I'm sorry if I have the numbers a little off, but I know I'm close. 58% of his patients made really great strides. Really strong improvements like Walker, where, you know, Walker is what you would want your child to be.
Yeah. Temple Grandin was my guest on this program a few years ago, and she spoke about the need to keep autistic children engaged, and she's praised your book. And one of the things that I found interesting about her is that she continues to grow, if that's the right word, or her functionality continues to improve. For example, she was well into adulthood before she felt comfortable shaking someone's hand. So it seems to me that there's a possibility for progress throughout one's life, no matter where you are in this sensory integration disorder spectrum.
Exactly. I mean, I've noticed that just sort of studying it and going to conferences and meeting people who had it and now seem to be sort of, at least from the way I would observe it, to be coming out of it, I think that the brain is always in some ways changing. The brain can grow and change. And Greenspan talks about, he says, you know, what does it matter if your kid, okay, so your kid's supposed to do something at age 6, but your kid does it at age 9 or age 12. What does it matter? It's you're passing through the phases of development. And I suspect with Temple Grandin that she, it took her a long time to become desensitized, to just get used to a lot of the sensory input that she gets from the world. But I also think that she has become, from what I've read, it looks like she's actually grown psychologically as well, that she, you know, had started off very naive in the business world and was taken advantage of by her colleagues and stuff, and now she's gotten rather wily, and that she can lie a little bit if she needs to or whatever, and that she's, when I've seen her speak, she's actually incredibly, has a wry sense of humor and seems to really understand what makes other people tick, which, you know, is really the opposite of what we imagine autism to be.
Right. She's a very curious, I mean, she has a great sense of curiosity is what I'm trying to say here. I was going to say something that wasn't what I meant, but her curiosity is amazing. I mean, you know, I'm doing the interview and she's asking me questions. You know?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She's an amazing person.
Yeah.
And, yeah, she is. She's full, she has this hunger for knowing.
Yeah.
And,
that's, yeah.
And I think she knows more than you imagine that she should. She's just, she's got a great sense of humor, too.
Yeah. Many successes in her life. And her book, she's written a book, Thinking in Pictures, which is a really good read.
Oh, it is,
isn't
it?
Well, yeah. Very good. Oh, gosh. What do we need to wrap up? We're going to wrap up here pretty quickly. But what would you like to leave us with this afternoon?
Well, I think, it's very important just to reiterate the fact that the brain can heal. And that the brain heals best in the really early years. And if anyone has any suspicions, even the vaguest suspicions about a child's development, I would say to jump on it. You can never hurt a child from giving them too much interaction or too much attention or too much tutoring. You can hurt a child from not, because the brain can start to grow in the wrong ways.
Yeah.
How much more time do we have?
Not much. I do have two quick questions for you,
okay,
though. You know, Walker was so sensitive to so many things, yet he was drawn to windows. Isn't that interesting? I mean, it says so much about there is still, I mean, windows are about light, you know?
Yes.
So he was drawn to the light.
Well, that's why I called the book The Boy Who Loved Windows, because for me it means a couple things. I mean, one is it's you're drawn to light. It must be something, you know, really deeply innate in humans that, you know, if you're not connecting with other things, that you just are, you know, focused on light. But that later for me what it came to mean is that he just had this passion for life and for growing and for changing.
Yeah. And so even though it seemed he was shut down, he was, you know, he was in there.
Yes, he was. And I knew it. See, that, I think that's what could be really hard to say to a doctor, I think something's wrong with this child, because I, on some level, he was sort of there. I mean, I knew kind of what he was, but it was muted. And it was almost like he was trying to get out. And this therapy that we did just helped him step out.
Mm. What kind of reaction is the book getting?
Oh, it's been remarkable. It's reviewed in the Oprah magazine this month, and they say wonderful things about it. And I've been getting phone calls from people all over the country thanking me for telling the story. And it has a lot of information in it too that I think some people are finding interesting. And it's kind of a page-turner book.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, but it's been really amazing for me because, as you know from the book, I spent years, you know, in that darkened room practically,
right,
you know, on the floor with my son and then, of course, alone writing the book. So it's been a powerful experience connecting with people.
Yeah, the windows are open.
Exactly.
Patricia, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It was my pleasure.
Patricia Stacy has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of The Boy Who Loved Windows, Opening the Heart and Mind of a Child Threatened with Autism.